And the next case is United States of America versus O'Neill Russell. Mr. Slatkin is here for the appellant. Ms. Gershaw is here for the government.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Attorney Robert Slack, and I represent O'Neill Russell in the following matter. Your Honor, with your permission, I would like to start my discussion, and I think it's because it's most salient, and I think it's basically a threshold matter on the supplemental brief that was actually requested by this court, because I think it kind of dictates the other issues that were brought up in the appellant's brief to the court. This court had directed appellant to file a supplemental brief, and also the government as well, because during the course of the appeal, the Supreme Court in Rehab versus United States decided a case that was very, very salient to the issues brought up in appellant's brief. Specifically, the Supreme Court held that knowledge in statute 18 U.S.C. 922G5, and specifically in this subsection A, knowledge would not only apply to knowledge of possession of a firearm. Now, knowledge would also apply to actual knowledge of a defendant's illegal status. And I want to direct the court's attention specifically to the motion in limine filed at the district court level. I believe it's docket number 62. In that motion in limine, the United States argued both in the actual limine itself and also to the district court during trial that two different petitions should be prevented from being introduced by the defense at that time, appellant. And those two are petition I-130 and, more salient, petition I-485. Now, these petitions are basically petitions that are designed to, the first one is, the first file would be I-130.
The one I-485.
Yes.
Can you make an argument that document was relevant as to your client's knowledge?
Yes.
About whether or not he was legally or illegally or unlawfully in the United States at the time that he possessed the firearm?
Yes. Your Honor, I do believe that that is very salient to the fact that he has knowledge.
Why is that? Can you make that argument?
Yes, I can. He was the one that actually filed that. I believe that he was not, it's not necessarily clear from the record that he was even notified that that was in fact denied. So on top of the fact that he has maintained throughout the pendency of the litigation that he was in fact illegal or had legal status. I know that that was done even by himself constantly to the trial court, and also subsequently by his counsel when he was discussing sentencing factors. And specifically, the I-485, had it been a pending application in his mind, maybe delusional or otherwise, whether or not, the fact is, it's not a reasonable standard as to whether or not that pending I-485 was actually pending, and moreover, whether it was even valid. Because that's not the issue that we're discussing. The issue we're discussing is whether or not he believed it was valid.
So your argument is that the motion in limine may have been denied if the court had the benefit of the Rehaff opinion?
I think it would absolutely have been denied.
Okay, well, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yes.
What's the best argument that you can make in support of that? So it would have to go to his knowledge, because the jury wasn't instructed on knowledge, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
At that time, the jury instructions were designed and based on this court's, at that time, opinion.
If we say there was an error, then what would be the relief?
The relief would be to remand for a new trial with the specific instruction that he would be permitted to enter in any evidence of that I-485 and also to argue it and also to testify to it.
All right, so I just want to make sure there's no double jeopardy issue here, right?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So, again, going to, I mean, the United States practically conceded to the fact that this was going to be knowledge, because why else would they have cited to the rehab opinion at that time if the United States didn't believe that that was going to be evidence of knowledge? They specifically, in their arguments, both again in the actual brief, in the actual motion in limine itself, it's as if you know, someone wouldn't be bringing up this opinion unless there was some potentially discussions or that the United States was under the belief that this was going to be used for knowledge. And the United...
Now, when the government filed its motion in limine, was there an objection?
There, I believe there was an objection.
Okay, the government says that there was no objection.
I believe that that it was both objected to. At least there was no ruling. It was...
Okay, all right.
Let me ask you, would it matter? I mean, at that time, both parties were going under the assumption that knowledge was irrelevant.
And I think that's a good point, Your Honor. It would not have necessarily mattered if we take into consideration the new case law. No.
And you get the benefit of that because we're at the direct appeal stage.
That's correct.
I think Justice Alito said you get the benefit of the new Supreme Court opinion when you're at the if it's still on direct appeal.
That is correct, Your Honor. In Kentucky versus Griffin, I believe that the Supreme Court held that when you're at the direct appeal stage, you are more than welcome to argue as you know, decisions that go specifically towards issues that were on appeal. And there's no doubt, and again, I want to make it clear that there is a bit of a distinction here, because there's an important distinction that we're talking about here in terms of the fact that this is not a new issue. The appellant's brief, this was an issue that we had brought up. This is not like, you know, if we turn to this court's opinion in United States versus Durham, where we had a case that was involving the ACCA and whether or not the defendant couldn't be sentenced under the ACCA. Now, I want to make a distinction here because that was a completely new issue. We're not talking about just, in that case, a new issue plus a new decision. Or in that case, we were talking about a new issue plus a new decision.
What if the government says that if we look at the record, there's more than enough evidence to establish that he knew that he was illegally and unlawfully in the United States, so therefore there should be no new trial because there's enough evidence in the record to establish knowledge?
I would say that because specifically that he was denied from mounting a defense to that completely, and also because, well, first of all, I'm not necessarily sure that that is actually in fact true, that there is enough, especially considering the fact that the jury instructions, they weren't even made aware that that was something they're considering.
Don't you want to say it's an element of the crime and you need a jury verdict on it? Isn't that your argument? Or maybe it's not an element of the crime. Is it an element of the crime or not?
I believe now it is an element of the crime.
All right.
Yes. I believe it is an element.
So if it's an element of the crime, it needs to be put to the jury.
That is correct.
Would you concede that the jury could have inferred from Officer LaSance's testimony in the I-94 admission form that Russell knew he was here illegally?
I believe that they could assume potentially, yes, I would concede that that would be somewhat evidence. I would concede that point.
And on a related note, in your supplemental brief, you state that Rahafe changes the analysis of your first argument, which was you were advancing a quasi-status argument. Are you abandoning that issue?
I'm not necessarily abandoning that issue completely, Your Honor. I do think that this new case law kind of makes that issue not fully moot, but in somewhat it changes the discussion of the argument, because as we know now, there is a separate element to be proven, that in that case, we were discussing specifically the validity without knowledge. In other words, the issue was he under legal status or was he not under legal status? Now, that is still an argument that we are advancing, but however...
Still traveling under a quasi-status argument additionally.
In addition, yes.
And
I can touch briefly on...
Why? You know that every circuit has rejected that position. Why should we do anything differently?
Your Honor, I would just say briefly, and I know I made many of these points in my brief, but just to touch on them here again, I think there is some merit to the fact that when someone is working and living in the United States under a certain type of status, lesser than full citizenship or lesser than visa status, that person should not necessarily be subjected to as harsh a punishment as this, because this is not just necessarily punishing them for having a firearm, it's punishing them for having a firearm while being illegal at the same time.
Yeah, you know, but hasn't the Supreme Court kind of fixed this now by putting the element of knowledge in there?
I think it does. It went a long way in towards fixing that error. So,
I think we have your argument, Mr. Zlatkin.
Yes.
And you've reserved some time for rebuttal.
I did. Thank you so much.
We'll hear from the government. Ms. Gershaw.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Let me start by framing what this argument is and what it isn't. Russell's rehafe argument is that the error affected the admissibility of his I-485 application for adjustment of status. But in his supplemental briefing, he said, we are not challenging the jury instructions. Without a challenge to the jury instruction, the error with respect to the admission of the evidence is necessarily harmless, because if the jury is not instructed that it has to find that the defendant knew of his prohibited status, it's simply not relevant to the issue of what the jury had to find. And now, there might be a reason that the defendant is not challenging the jury instruction, and that is that the jury instructions were jointly submitted. That's document 72. And if you look at the jointly submitted jury instruction, instruction 12, that instruction instructs that to prove the elements of a 922 G5 conviction, it does not include a knowledge of prohibited status element.
Well, there was obviously no objection to the jury instruction, because neither the court nor the defendant had the benefit of the Rahafe opinion.
That is true, Your Honor, but this goes beyond just not objecting. This was a jointly submitted instruction, which means that...
Well, how could he do anything else at that time?
Well,
he's got an 11th Circuit case right on point. He, you know, he's kind of like be wasting the court's time to do anything else.
I disagree, Your Honor, because although the 11th Circuit had ruled on that issue, the defendant in rehafe had filed for cert, and given the composition of the court and Justice Gorsuch's, when he was on the 10th Circuit, his concurrent opinion in which he discussed 922G and the knowledge element, I think they absolutely had notice that this is an issue that should be preserved. And not only did he not preserve the issue, but when he was asked during the hearing on the motion in limine, the court said to him, are you arguing that because he had a subjective belief that he was in the United States lawfully, that defeats prosecution? And the defense counsel said, no, Your Honor, that's not what I'm arguing. So even putting aside the invited error with respect to the jury instruction, this argument about rehafe and the admissibility of the evidence should be reviewed for plain error, because he has never advanced that argument. And while it is true that the United States brought that up in the motion in limine, all that was doing was saying, these are arguments that we anticipate the defendant might make. But when the defendant specifically disclaims that he's making that argument, he shouldn't get the benefit of the United States' assumption that he might make that argument in order to preserve it for review. And under plain error review, he cannot meet his burden of showing that this error affected his substantial rights. And I think this goes to Judge Wilson's point that what is it, first of all, about an application for adjustment of status that would give the defendant a belief that he was lawfully in the United States? In order to get from the admission of the I-485 application for adjustment of status to that finding, there would have had to be additional testimony or additional evidence to show why it mattered. And even Judge Wilson, when you asked defense counsel to explain it, I didn't hear an explanation about why this would show that he believed that he was lawfully in the United States.
Well, there's a difference between arguing that an I-485 application gives you legal status. There's a difference between that and I thought it gave me legal status. And isn't that the issue in Rahaf, whether he has knowledge, not whether the I-485 gives you legal status, but whether the defendant knew or understood that he had legal status? Isn't there a difference between the two things?
There are. There's exactly a difference. And that's why I don't think he's laid the foundation for saying, I believed that this application gave me status.
But if he had the benefit of the Rahaf opinion, he could argue to the jury, I thought that I was legally in the United States. That's the issue, isn't it?
But that's mere speculation that that's what he would do. And under Rodriguez, the court says, if you have to speculate that the outcome would be different, the defendant hasn't met his burden under plain error review under the third prong. But even more so, that's just assuming that this was a valid I-485 application. Here, what the record as a whole shows is that his application for adjustment of status was based on an invalid marriage. He was already married to a woman in Jamaica when he entered into the so-called marriage with a U.S. citizen. So to say that had all of this information been presented to the jury, that he says, I believed I was lawful in the United States because I had a pending I-485 application, and the evidence was introduced that...
Well, the jury could have believed him or the jury could have disbelieved him. That's up to the jury.
That is up to the jury, and if it were on preserved error review, I would absolutely agree with you. But because it's plain error, he has to say more than just there's a possibility that the jury would believe him. He has to show a reasonable likelihood that the result would be different. And I don't think that given of the evidence that this marriage application, that this marriage was fraudulent and that he was both intending to deceive the United States in order to obtain legal status and then wants to deceive the jury into believing that he was lawfully in the United States, that doesn't meet the standard for the third prong of plain error review. And it also doesn't meet the standard for reversal under the fourth standard of plain error review, which says that the error has to go to the integrity of the judicial proceeding. And I don't think that it advances the integrity of the judicial proceeding to allow him to go back to present evidence of a fraudulent immigration application.
For the marriage-based immigration application, had that been withdrawn by his American wife before he was arrested?
It was, Your Honor.
So at the time he was arrested, that application is no longer pending.
That is correct. And I believe his argument would be, well, I didn't know that it wasn't pending because I wasn't notified until 2016. But certainly the evidence is that he had left his wife. She had written to the immigration office and said, my illegal husband has left me. The divorce papers that he showed me were fraudulent. All the evidence in the record shows that he never had a valid marriage to this person to begin with, and what he wants to do is try to deceive the jury into believing that he believed, based on this fraudulent marriage application, that he had lawful status, and I believe that that is a bridge too far under plain error review.
Let me ask you this. I think what he's saying in his brief is there was no fight at the time about the jury instruction. I didn't ask for a different jury instruction. He's going under the fact that he wanted to put in evidence of his client's belief. And if he got that evidence in because it was relevant, then they would be arguing about a jury instruction. But without that evidence, there's no argument. I think that's why you can say there's no argument about the jury instruction. But once the Supreme Court changes its changes the law, then that changes the whole situation. So the Supreme Court said basically the harmless error, we'd be back there. But how can you have harmless error in this case when there's factual issues about what his beliefs were, and there's evidence that he's going to argue show those beliefs? Well, I mean, they may be crazy beliefs, but they're his beliefs.
In Henderson versus United States, the Supreme Court said that plain error review applies even when there is a new rule of law. So the Supreme Court has contemplated circumstances such as this and said it doesn't matter that it's a new law. The standards of review, such as plain error, and I would argue invited error, still apply even if the law changes. He didn't have to submit a joint jury instruction. This was his proposed instruction. And yes, I agree with you that was the current state of the law, but he didn't have to submit a joint instruction. He didn't have to agree with it.
Okay,
but
his evidence is out. What jury instruction can he submit if his evidence is out at that point?
His jury instruction was submitted before the district court made its ruling on the I-485 on the admissibility of the I-485 application.
Well, had there been a... Okay, all right. That's your argument.
That's my argument. Unless the court has any further questions on this issue, I would turn to the argument in his brief about the legal status or quasi-legal status of someone with a pending I-485 application. And as Judge Branch recognized, every circuit to have considered this issue has said your status doesn't change until your application is approved. And that makes complete sense. There's nothing in the statute that would suggest that merely by filing an application to change your status, that would permit you to possess a firearm. And I think that's especially relevant here when you look at 922G5 as a total. Mr. Russell came into the United States under a tourist visa. Under 922G5B, he would not be allowed to possess a firearm while he was here on a tourist visa. Then so if he had applied for adjustment of status while he was still on his tourist visa, he would not be able to possess a firearm because he was here lawfully under a tourist visa. So the idea that he comes into the country on a tourist visa where he would not be allowed to possess a firearm, he then overstays his visa so he is unlawfully in the United States, and then files an application for adjustment of status, then merely by doing that, Congress would have intended for him to have been able to possess a firearm when he wouldn't have been able to when he came in under his original authorization. And the mere fact that someone who is here unlawfully but it can't be deported and is allowed to work doesn't change his legal status. They're just two separate inquiries. One comes from the practicality of if you have people here and they can't be deported, you need to allow them to work so that they don't become a public charge. But that doesn't mean that Congress intended for them to be able to possess a firearm. So
Can I ask a question about your supplemental brief? I thought it was rather a disingenuous argument that because the court asked for supplemental briefing, that the defendant doesn't get the benefit of that unless he asks for the supplemental briefing. I mean, I thought that was rather a strange approach, especially because how do we know that he wasn't going to ask for supplemental briefing the next day? I mean, I just didn't understand that argument at all.
I was merely pointing out the framework under Durham, because prior to Durham, the court would not consider any new arguments raised in supplemental briefing, even if the law had changed. And in Durham, this court, when it went en banc, created a limited exception to that and said, these new issues can be raised, but in order to do so, the defendant has to timely move to do it. And so I would argue that he didn't timely move. The rehave decision came out in June of 2019. We're in December of 2019 when the court ordered supplemental briefing. And I'm not saying that the court shouldn't consider it. I was merely letting the court know of the framework, what our position was, and that the issue should be limited to what had already been raised in his brief, which was the admissibility of the evidence, because since there was supplemental briefing and I only had 5 pages, I didn't know what argument he was going to raise, so I was trying to cabin the argument to what I think would be appropriate for the court to consider, which is the admissibility of the effect of rehafe on the admissibility of the application. I did not mean to be disingenuous with the court. That was not my intent. If the court...
I see no more questions. Thank you, Ms. Gershaw.
Thank you. I would ask that you affirm.
We'll hear again from Mr. Zlatkin.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court again. I'll keep this fairly brief.
Well, let me ask you, what did you mean in your supplemental brief when you said here the issue is not regarding the jury instructions?
Your Honor, I think... it is exactly as you had pointed out to defense. I think that we were simply hamstrung by the fact that we couldn't have objected to the jury instructions because we were under the benefit of rehafe. So I don't know if it even matters when he whether he agreed or he did not agree to the jury instructions. Moreover, I don't think it matters when he did so and whether it happened before or after the motion in limine. The bottom line was he didn't have the benefit of objecting to these things. So now when we're talking about it, the direct obvious error is that he was unable to introduce any type of evidence. He was unable to make any type of argument, and we're not simply speculating. I mean, we know from the record clearly that Russell, even before I'm talking about the defendant's own words, even before they started discussing the motion in limine, he went on a diatribe. I know I'm not illegal. I know I'm not. I have this. I have that. We don't know what exactly he would have testified had he had the benefit of rehafe. So my argument is necessarily that he did not have the benefit to provide any evidence, and thus, he was completely hamstrung. It would be complete manifest injustice to say that, yes, so they didn't object to the jury instructions. They didn't object timely or before or after. But they just simply didn't, they were operating under clear precedent.
Let me ask you a question about the timing of a timing issue related to rehafe. Mm-hmm. Was the cert petition pending or had it been granted at the time that you submitted the joint jury instructions?
I don't know the answer to that question. But I believe it was pending. It might have been. But I would have to double check. I mean, that is my argument.
You were the trial lawyer?
No, I was not.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we have your arguments.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.